Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapult to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed split-level location in a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
You may not know it, but you're standing in the middle of a battlefield. Today, we hope to bring you some intelligence from behind enemy lines. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Thank you for listening, VFTB.net, watching at youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. This is unprecedented on A View from the Bunker, at least in this format. In years past, we've had the opportunity to hold some round table discussions at prophecy conferences. This one we're doing virtually through Skype, and we're praying for lots and lots of internet bandwidth over the next hour or so as we bring you the four co-authors of a brand new book, Revising Reality, A Biblical Look into the Cosmos, Volume 1. We'll start and go left to right across your radio dial, as the old saying goes. Publisher, speaker, researcher, author, co-author of the best-selling book, The Final Babylon. He's the author of such books as Uncommon Sense, Lying Wonders of the Red Planet, The Next Great War in the Middle East, and he's a contributing author to Blood on the Altar and Pandemonium's Engine. Welcome our good friend Doug Woodward. Doug, good to see you again.
Hi, Derek. Great to be with you. Thank you.
Next, we bring in filmmaker, podcaster, author, the producer-director of the films Age of Deceit and Age of Deceit 2, and director of the multiple Telly Award-winning documentary film Inhuman, The Next and Final Phase of Man is Here. He's co-host of Canary Cry Radio, Canary Cry Talk Radio, and he is the guy you see at the Face Like the Sun YouTube channel, Gans Shimura. Gans, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Derek. Appreciate you inviting us all on.
Well, I'm glad we can all work this out and get our schedules coordinated for this. No oceans here in the Ozarks, but the cows say hello.
Too bad.
Sitting in the next room, but Skyping in anyway, author, podcaster, and television host. Never thought you'd see that on your resume, eh? He's the author of the excellent books, Quantum Creation, Cherubim Chariots, co-author of the new book with Tom Horn, Abaddon Ascending. We had a long debate about how to pronounce that. Host of Into the Multiverse on Skywatch TV with his wife, Christina Peck, and often sits in on the panel discussions at Skywatch TV. We welcome Josh Peck. Josh.
Hey, Derek. It's good to talk with you again. It's been so long.
Yeah. Except this time we get to do it with a half-second delay between the wall.
And yeah, so that's always good.
Finally, author and speaker who is in high demand, especially lately, because the topic that he is specializing in has been the focus of a lot of conversation recently. He is a researcher into physics, cosmology, biology, and computer science, as well as, most importantly, theology. He's written two novels, Covert Catastrophe and 2048 Diamonds in the Rough. He's a frequent guest on the programs that deal with so-called fringe topics, such as Caravan to Midnight, Ground Zero with Clyde Lewis, Hagman and Hagman, as well as others, known for his cutting-edge research into CERN's Large Hadron Collider. We welcome for the first time to the program Anthony Patch. Anthony, it's good to meet you.
Well, same here, Derek. Thank you for having all of us together in one place. And we have two young gentlemen here who are starting families, I understand.
Hmm.
Well, let the cat out of the bag.
Well, Josh has got a kind of a head start on that.
I have three kids, and our most recent one, he's only 2 months old, but he's the size of a 6 month old. We found that out yesterday at Skywatch because one of the other ladies brought in their 6 month old, and Christina brought in Adam, and we realized they're the same size. So, yeah, he's a big boy.
Yeah, but
both mothers probably felt some trepidation over that fact, I bet.
Yeah.
But congratulations are due to you, Gans. When is the happy day?
It's supposed to be in March 2017, so looking forward to it. I'm already a father. I'm a stepfather, so it's not, a completely new world, but it's definitely different, and it'll be interesting to see how it all works out. We'll see if we, become our own nation, and that'll be interesting. That might cause us to jump borders here in the near future, but we'll see. We'll have to see it. But March 2017, it's a girl. And looking forward to it.
Right. The Ides of March. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Well, here is the book. It is Revising Reality, Volume 1. And all four of these gentlemen have contributed to the book in various ways, sometimes co-authoring chapters, sometimes writing independently. And so we'll try to play the role of point guard here and hopefully pass the ball around enough to give you, the viewer, listener, a taste of what is in this book, because a lot of ground gets covered. And during this conversation, we're only going to scratch the surface. Let's start off with the Genesis 6 paradigm, which is what opens the book. And Doug and Josh, we'll start with you, Doug. You open the book by describing the incident at Mount Hermon and what that led to, the Nephilim, the giants who were in the land in those days. How did the Nephilim, the giants, change the course of human history?
Yeah, and then, you know, what we tried to do in the book is bring together a lot of the really salient, much talked about issues. Probably over the last 4 or 5 years, the Nephilim has been perhaps one of the most controversial and frequent and popular subjects for discussion. And so, you know, what we looked at is we sort of gathered together all the issues that we thought should be in the book, and we came up with a name that can cover so many different factors and so many different issues. As it pertains specifically to the Nephilim and the cosmos, you know, in the sort of, we'll call it the standard paradigm, which we were all taught in school and which we still hear on the History Channel and the Discovery Channel and so forth, the concept of other dimensional beings is certainly not one that we hear about. The idea that other dimensional beings could somehow come to the other side and actually somehow mix their DNA with our DNA, that's just, it sounds so totally absurd. And yet that's where so many of us in our community that speak and talk on eschatology and these things, that's so much of what we've really been talking about. So what I asked Josh to do was to really assemble some research that really kind of brings together these ideas to start the book off, because it is a fundamental reshaping of our thinking about reality, that there are other dimensional beings and that somehow there is enough compatibility between them and us that we could have offspring together. I mean, wow, you know, remarkable. So, but I'm just kind of teeing this up for Josh, Derek. So, but that provides the context to how we begin the book and why we started with that subject.
Well, Josh, why does there seem to be so much resistance to this concept in the church? How much of this stems from the, shall we say, in training or indoctrination, if you will, we have in as English speakers to the word G-O-D?
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest hurdles that I find a lot of Christians who aren't already in this type of research or in this knowledge or whatever we want to call it. That's the biggest hurdle that they have to go through is what G-O-D, what God actually means in the Bible, because it is true that there are no other gods before Yahweh, the God of Israel, the God of the Bible. But it also does refer to other gods, what we would say like little g gods or false gods. And really it all comes from an understanding of what the Elohim are. And I think that basic foundation is something that's missing in a lot of the church. And until we deal with that, we can't really get into things like, you know, Nephilim and extra dimensional beings and things like that without laying a foundation of what the Elohim actually is. So that's what I do in the book, starting off. And once we get there, and I'm sure most of your audience, Derek, is already going to be familiar with that. So in the book, it's not like the whole book is stuff that people have already heard before. It's all brand new information, but there is a brief foundation there just in case somebody who hasn't heard this stuff is brand new to it. They'll be able to pick this book up too and understand it just fine. So we're not, you know, totally overloading somebody who this is all brand new. But once you get into that idea of that there, the word God in English isn't just universal to the God that we worship, Yahweh. It can mean a number of things. And Dr. Michael Heiser has gone through and did a lot of awesome research on this too. But it can mean angels. It can mean basically the way that I see it is it's more of an attribute of physicality almost. Like what we would call like just some like a supernatural being. You know, we call that an Elohim. And Mike Heiser says it this way. He says that God or Yahweh is an Elohim, but no other Elohim is like Yahweh. He's independent of his in his own right. So it's just like if we were to say, yes, God is a supernatural being or he's a spirit, but no other supernatural being or spirit is like him. So once we start thinking of the word God like that, then a lot of things like Psalm 82 and all these things that don't make any sense on a surface reading, they start to become clearer, how these other gods can die like men and things like that. Right. And it also helps bring things like Genesis 6 into more focus. And I think it's in dealing with this God issue of why some people believe that Genesis 6 is just talking about, you know, like the descendants of Cain and the descendants of Seth commingling, and that's all it was. There wasn't anything supernatural, you know, the Sethite theory, which in my opinion is it just doesn't hold any water. But when we have a supernatural view of it, of these fallen, we would just call them fallen angels or false gods or however we want to refer to them, they actually fell and commingled with human women. And like Doug so accurately pointed out, they at least have enough in common with us on a genetic level that they can commingle and create offspring with us, which is strange. But once we realize that and can get there, that opens the Bible to all sorts of new possibilities that a lot of the church won't consider, and actually has a lot to do with where we as the human race are going in the future. And that's what really sets the pace of this book and why it's even called Revising Reality. Because even our understanding of ancient things in the church, that needs to be revised now.
Yeah. You know, Gons, you wrote about the Divine Council in the book here, and we can see that the work of Dr. Heiser kind of weaves its way through a lot of the research in the book here. It's all through the book that I'm working on that'll be out in the spring. What are the implications of the Divine Council, the fact that there are other small g gods, that God in the Bible calls them gods? What role do they play? Why does it matter?
Yeah, I think you know, in the church, we've used terms like heavenly hosts, and we've talked about angels, and, you know, those are sort of surface level understanding of some of these things. But when you start looking at, obviously, Dr. Heiser's work, he's the unseen hand. I'll call him the unseen Gandalf throughout this book here. But
right.
what he laid out and what I tried to sort of repackage in a chapter, which is really difficult to do, and with the help of Doug Woodward, the chapter came out a lot better than it would have been if it was just me. So thank you, Doug. But really, the reason why it's important to understand kind of that paradigm is because it gives personality, number one, to these divine beings. It's not just, you know, they're not just these whispering air spirits that kind of just do whatever God says. They have their own personality, their own character, and that's something that I think we overlook or we just don't consider. But then also the rebellion from within that has everything to do with God's acting in the Old Testament and why Jesus even came, and everything related to the gospel. It all sort of none of it changes per se, but there's a deeper level of understanding that really puts these bigger issues of what we're looking at into the right context biblically, and realizing that, wow, the Bible really has been saying this kind of stuff all along, even with the new science that is being discovered. It's the same sort of truth that the Word of God has contained within it all this time, but now we have this point in history where we're able to start looking at it differently. We're starting to understand creation differently, and that in itself, you know, changes our reality causes us to revise reality. But the in that process, having that divine council worldview is sort of it's comforting in a sense, because all the stuff that's being, you know, investigated with the paranormal and even the supernatural topics, transhumanism with the future, what the future has in store for us, the divine council paradigm makes complete sense within all that. In that, you know, the hierarchy of God, the rebellion of the angels, and how God is going to restore all that, and man's attempt to restore that, And that has to do with the Tower of Babel. It has to do with, I think, the eventual outcome of the Mark of the Beast and the image of the beast. And there's this constant battle going on between God, his plan, and man through the influence of some nefarious angels and fallen divine beings to figure out that salvation on our own. And that's been the conflict all along. And so I just think it gives us a deeper understanding of the Word of God, and that it's so relevant. All the Old Testament stuff that you thought was completely nonsensical, or just God being some kind of tyrant, right? No, there was a really important purpose behind everything he did in disinheriting the nations, the scattering of the nations at the Tower of Babel. There's a reason for that. You know, choosing his family line in Israel, but then understanding that that was a process that allowed salvation to become available to all of creation and all of man, actually, and then through that creation. So it's just a really, for me, Dr. Heiser's work has really shifted my thinking in grounding stuff in Scripture in a way that the church, at least right now, is not providing for those who have deeper questions. Mm-hmm. So I think the Divine Council is that sort of gateway, if you want to call it that, that opens up to some of those deeper issues. And then you can kind of go, you know, wherever the rabbit trail may take you, into some of the fringiest, craziest places, but feel okay.
Kind of like this conversation, which is going to do, I can already tell.
Right.
Well, the thing for me is that it makes the history of the Old Testament a lot easier to understand, you know, why Joshua was told, you know, these people here are Karem. They are to be utterly destroyed. And these people are to be utterly destroyed. These people you can make a treaty with, but these people over here, even their animals, you got to destroy them. Why? And that's what the Divine Council concept, when you understand it, explains, that those people who were designated for Karem, or put under the ban, were totally sold out to these fallen entities, these fallen angels that God calls gods. And that in Psalm 82, when he pronounces judgment, says there's a day coming when those gods are going to die, which is kind of amazing when you think about it. And that's really what's motivated my research for the book that's coming out in the spring, looking at the historical evidence for these spiritual encounters. And that's where I'm going to bring Anthony into the conversation, because you made reference to something that I think is fascinating, because I found some historical links between certain people in the ancient Near East and the golden age of Cronus, which you make reference to in your work. So this is where we go from the historical, the mythical, the legendary, to cutting edge science. How do we get from the ancient Near East circa 1500 BC, when the Israelites are basically conquering the land of Canaan, to a discussion of the golden age of Cronus, which of course is Greek mythology, into cutting edge physics and science and the research at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, Switzerland?
Well, the central point is Saturn itself and the worship of the black sun. Cronus being the original sun in the mythos of Saturn and Earth traveling along with Mars through the cosmos, and then electromagnetically being attracted by the sun into its present location. And therefore, what we have is a situation where what you might consider the previous Garden of Eden, not God's creation of the Garden of Eden, but more in keeping with the myth of the Garden of Eden as having existed on Earth, because it was enveloped in what is known as a plasma envelope surrounding both Saturn, Earth, and Mars at the same time. Now, this is the story. This is not biblical, but this is the storyline that is put forth. Those that practice the worship of the black sun, specifically Saturn itself, and the black cube, as we see represented throughout our planet in today's culture, they believe that their leadership, that these gods emanated from Saturn itself, and that perhaps even to this day, that leadership resides within Saturn, effectively imprisoned within Saturn. A lot of this is conjecture. A lot of this is putting pieces together. I'm not a practitioner of the black arts, so I don't know the details of all of this. and I don't choose to, but I know enough of it by just looking at the history, in particular in recent time with the Nazis, their worship of the black sun, and even into contemporary time, the worship of the black cube. And therefore, it begs the question, why is Saturn so important to people, particularly in the world of science, specifically in physics, so important to them today? And that's really one of the rabbit holes that I went down. And it sounds completely bizarre to think that we have any relationship to Saturn as human beings and as the planet Earth. But there is a model of the universe known as the electric model of the universe, put forth by the Thunderbolts Project, by those scientists and researchers. And in that, the planets themselves are all electrically connected. Mm-hmm. There's more to it than this, but there is an electrical connection that presently exists between all of the planets and the Earth and the Sun. What one of the goals at CERN is to enhance that electrical connection, utilizing technology, specifically the collider, to enhance that electrical connection between the planet Earth and Saturn itself, to enhance that line of communication with these entities that, in their mythos and their belief, reside or are imprisoned within Saturn itself. Again, extremely bizarre to even think of this, but mm-hmm. you may want to go to Troy McLaughlin's work and see more of that on the Golden Age of Kronos.
Now, the Golden Age of Kronos, according to the Greeks, was an age when mankind enjoyed a life of ease and plenty, didn't have to work for everything because the ground just produced it automatically. Kronos, of course, replaced his father, and in turn, Kronos was then, Kronos, who was the predecessor to Kronos, was...
Well, you're testing our mythology
I should remember this.
yes, well, there is the issue of Kronos killing and eating his son.
Right.
You know, that may be part of what you're thinking about, because that's supposedly... was part of the Kronos mythology.
Well, he castrated his father because his father was not being very nice to his mother Gaia, who was mother who Kronos was the king of the Titans, basically. And then eventually he was replaced because of a prophecy that he would be deposed by his children, and so he swallowed his children. But a stone was substituted for Zeus, and Zeus wound up then deposing.
There you go.
Kronos, and sending him down to Tartarus with the rest of the Titans after the war, the Titanomachy. In Roman legend, it was similar. Saturn was said to have emigrated to Italy after being deposed in Greece by Zeus or Jupiter.
Right.
Yeah, and.
Yep.
And so you've got
one thing to keep in mind is that these myths are actually portraying what is being observed in the heavens physically.
Yeah.
And so you see the birth of Jupiter from Saturn. And so these demigods, these human forms, if you will, are attached to what is really taking place in the heavens. And these are observations of plasma discharges, for example, that are recorded on hieroglyphics and stone carvings on our planet by virtually every culture simultaneously. So really what we're seeing is just humans trying to understand and to put some context mm-hmm. to what they're seeing in the heavens, because Saturn was much closer to Earth at one point and was in direct alignment with Earth and in closer proximity and having this more enhanced electrical connection by way of what are known as Birkeland currents. So what is going on now is trying to reproduce that golden age that occurred when that close proximity existed.
Hmm. It was Uranus, by the way. I finally remembered Uranus in the Greek mythology. The interesting
and you even
thing,
knew how to pronounce it. That's amazing.
Yeah, well, you know, the old joke's been overdone. But that is actually draws from an older myth that comes from the Hurrian culture, which was the northern Mesopotamians, where the gods were Anu instead of Uranus, it was Kumarbi instead of Kronos, and it was not Enlil, but the storm god Teshub, that we would know as Baal in Canaanite mythology. And that goes back further to Sumerian myth, with a sky god replaced by a younger god, replaced by Enlil, the chief of the Sumerian pantheon. So this goes all the way back to immediate post-flood time. So, but the goal then, Anthony, if I understand it, is that We've got this memory that is being preserved by these secret societies, these occultists, of a day right. in which the Titans ruled the world, which was the mm-hmm. Golden Age, and they're trying to recreate this through cutting-edge technology and reproducing the conditions that existed, they think, when Saturn was closer to Earth and was electrically connected to Earth. By the way, was Arthur C. Clarke on board with this idea? Because the original, his novel, 2001: A Space Odyssey, it wasn't Jupiter mm-hmm. that it was Saturn.
That is mm-hmm. correct. That is mm-hmm. correct. And the black obelisk, if you will,
right.
from his book was a rectangle, when in fact what he wanted to present was the black cube of Saturn, which is in the center of the gaseous body of the planet itself.
Huh.
But he couldn't come right out and reveal everything he knew. Now, there was an interview I had with Doug Hagman not long ago in which we revisited the cube, and he made the statement that he had contacted some of his intelligence community contacts. And one gentleman in particular, when he brought up the black cube, said, "You don't know what you're talking about, Doug." And he said, "That's right, I don't," relative to the cube. And he said, "Let me explain to you that everyone at the higher echelons in the intelligence communities know all about the black cube of Saturn."
Really?
Yes. What you pointed out also, Derek, is this unity that runs through all these mythologies. And one of the things that we break ground on it and go into it to some extent. And in Anthony's chapters, really, he goes into it and talks about the I guess you'd say the ubiquity, the pervasiveness of the black cube in world religions today.
Mm-hmm.
Even surprisingly, Islam, with a Kaaba mm-hmm. in Mecca, is right. a giant black cube.
Right.
And people, so, you know, they run around or they walk around in the form of rings in the same way that the rings of Saturn move around Saturn.
It's so a coincidence, I'm sure. It's just totally a coincidence.
Yeah, purely a coincidence. So,
for you coincidence theorists figure, in the right? audience, yeah. This is mind-boggling. Now, Josh, I know that you've done a lot of work on this and research on this for the book Abaddon Ascending. And you've got a head that's further around this complex physics. How is the Large Hadron Collider to be used in order to you know, get us closer to this goal?
Well, basically, from a physics standpoint, and that's where I took it with me and Tom's book, and I took it from that standpoint in this one too. Is what do the scientists believe? What do they believe they're doing? And I do, and Derek, you and I have talked about this before, but I do believe that 99% of the physicists at CERN have no idea what's going on. You know, right. I think a lot of them, they just want to know more about the reality of nature, and they're going to work to, you know, learn that. But I do believe that there's something behind the scenes pulling the strings for different reasons. And but the way that I've been looking at it is, okay, from a physics standpoint, what is CERN saying, and what might that mean? And you know, we live in a world where a lot of people don't care much about quantum physics because they've been told that
well, it's hard.
Yeah, it's hard. You got to be a genius to understand it, you know, and all of that. There's no such thing as having to be, you know, smart enough to understand it. It's ultimately quantum physics. It's the study of God's creation. God has a personal relationship with each of us. He wants to be accessible to each of us. So anybody can understand it just fine if they're interested in it. But we live in a world where they're told that you got to have a PhD or something to even wrap your head around this stuff, and it's not true. But so being in a world like that's given the people at CERN more liberty to put out things that they're trying to do. And they've even gone on record to say, and it's on their website, they've gone on record to say that they want to open doorways to other dimensions, and they want to measure and explore these other dimensions. They want to send messages into these other dimensions and see if anything comes back. And all that on the surface sounds like conspiracy theory, but until you actually go to the CERN website and it is all laid out. I mean, they actually have a plan on how to do this. So that's kind of where I see like their goals. Now, as I said before, I think a lot of the physicists just think, oh, okay, well, extra dimensions, that's really cool. That's interesting. Yeah. You know, that's just more about our reality. But I do think that there is a shadow governing body of some sort, and it might be purely spiritual, but I think that there are physical components too, that are setting all this in place towards an eventual goal. And I do think that that goal is to bring back some of these false gods, or open a doorway to have some type of communication with them, almost like a repeat of the Tower of Babel, just maybe a different method this time, but, or maybe the same method, you know, depending what theory one subscribes to. But again, they've gone on record to say that they want to open a portal to explore other dimensions and to communicate. So us as Christians, of course, we have the question, what are they going to be communicating with? It's not God, you know, because if we want to communicate with God, we can just pray to him. And, you know, we don't need technology and portals and all that to do that. And I think Revelation 9 might give us a pretty clear picture of what we could expect if something like that is ever achieved, and other areas of Bible prophecy. Mm. So it's kind of a very strange time we're living in. But that's that for me, that was one of my personal drives and why I wanted to be a part of this book is to get the word out, because, again, a lot of Christians don't want anything to do with science because they feel it's not compatible with the Bible, even though it absolutely is, or they feel it's too crazy and out there and it's too conspiratorial, even though it's not, because the people in charge of all these things are putting it out there for everybody. I mean, it's fact that they at least are trying to do this, or they think that they're not smart enough, and that's a lie from the enemy. Anybody can get the basics of this stuff. It's just like the Bible. You know, you have regular Christians who go to church every Sunday, and you have biblical scholars, but we're all on the same page, and we all worship the same God. So that's been my main motivation throughout the whole process of this book.
It's fascinating stuff. And I know, again, for you viewers / listeners, this is a kind of whirlwind tour around the book. So forgive me if you're suffering mental whiplash here, but want to keep this to a manageable length to listen in one sitting and still leave you with some things that will motivate you to actually get the book. Gons, to you on this one, I want to go to the chapter that you wrote about transhumanism, which, of course, is a topic that you have covered on Canary Cry Radio. And, of course, your work on the documentary Inhuman is what really helped win those awards. The role of man-machine hybrids in whatever portal opening takes place, what role will this technology and the transhumanist movement play?
Yeah, you know, it's an esoteric concept. It's very strange and bizarre, as Josh said, but it's true that there seems to be some sort of connection between what the elite, or, you know, you can even call it the tech industry, the technocracy that does exist here, what they're trying to do in getting humans to basically merge with a machine element. Just recently, I think we had Sam Harris come out and say, well, this is probably inevitably going to happen. You know, it might not be a good idea, because usually when we, have technologies to put into our brains, we want to have all that worked out. But basically, we're going to become puppets to whatever system is going to, you know, be injected into our brains. Ray Kurzweil has been on record to say that, you know, he wants to basically connect the internet to our brains. There is definitely a push. A strange but definite building to this idea of connecting the mind into this virtual realm. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that mean in terms of all this crazy stuff with CERN and portals and all that? Is this concept of perhaps whatever these entities may be, these spiritual entities, they need hosts. Now, you know, there's different theories out there about, hey, you know, the alien grays, they're sort of bred in laboratories as physical bodies, but then, you know, some nefarious spirits can inhabit them, and that's how they animate. Maybe, I don't know. I don't have hard proof of anything like that, but it's possible. But in that way, you know, in the same way that a believer can be filled with the Holy Spirit, there is also a fallen spirit that has, you know, control, or can have control if you give it access. And I think what they're trying to do is bring a higher arc of maybe, you know, the fallen entities that have, you know, been trapped in the abyss. Their release, as prophesied, might have something to do with that, with, you know, some sort of abominable thing where humanity is part of this, you know, re-emitting of the fallen demons throughout the earth. And transhumanism, as part of the vehicle, is sort of building the bridge towards the spiritual. CERN is trying to bridge that other side back here. And I think once that connects, then we have this basically a population that might be possessed, mm-hmm. literally. At a very deep level, to a point where the Holy Spirit can't reside. It can't even redeem you anymore. And that's what the disturbing parts about the Book of Revelation is, that reading that those who take the mark, those who worship the image of the beast and the dragon, there does not seem to be any kind of redemption for them. There's no what's the story? I'm totally blanking on the prodigal son. There's no prodigal son element to those who take the mark. There's not anything that indicates, you know what, actually later on, you know, you understood your mistake, you know, back into the kingdom of God. There doesn't seem to be that. Their smoke, their torment rises forever and ever. What causes that? What would be so detrimental to humankind that God would say, I can't even redeem you anymore? It has to be something that manipulates our DNA at a genetic level to a certain degree where we're not human anymore. And that ties all into the transhumanist discussion.
But it's something that would something that require a personal choice, though. It's not something that could be forced on you against your will.
Right.
Which is something.
And what you guys have been talking about with the cube and and all that stuff, the conditioning to accept this sort of reality is what we're also looking at and trying to expose. Because as I mentioned in the book, and this is something that startled me as I was looking at, you know, portals and all kinds of weird stuff. Disney XD last year when I checked. Every cartoon program, not one cartoon program did not have a portal with entities going through it, you know, different worlds, different whatever. Every single program, and this is Kids Channel, Disney XD, has a portal. So, I mean, they're trying to get the kids to understand there's these other worlds and you can go through them. Just recently, Doctor Strange, what's the whole, you know, he wears the key and what does he do? He spins, right? Whatever particle spinning opens a portal, right? So that concept is just being pushed all over the place. And so if you think this is just kind of crazy rhetoric stuff, once you start at least researching it, you'll begin to see it in culture, you know, where it's being taught, but not deliberately, you know, it's being conditioned into the public. So that's another aspect of it that, you know, I think the church needs to realize too, like, hey, you know, we're being conditioned by the media. It's not just entertainment.
So when something comes up, then, you know, the reaction of people will be not, well, you know, how could this be? I can't believe this is happening. Or, you know, this is demonic. The reaction will be, well, oh, sure, of course. It's just a portal opening. We're finally seeing one for real.
For real, right.
Derek, I was going to suggest this really tees up an issue that Anthony, I think, could speak to really, really well, which is this surprising connection between particle accelerators, DNA, and teleportation, which we talk about. I mean, we're talking about like Star Trek, and we're talking about DNA and discovering the basics of DNA and particle accelerators. You wouldn't think these things have a connection, but they have a vital connection to the storyline.
Well, right, and that relates to a line that I wanted to ask you about, Anthony, because it's I think I copied this down last night as I was reading the book because I thought this was really intriguing, and it kind of relates to what Doug just said, which is the whole linchpin between the science and the research and the myths and legends of this so-called golden age. You wrote, "Science at CERN combines what is known by the scientist with what is ventured by the alchemist." What did you mean
by
that?
That's correct. Well, scientists really are nothing more than the alchemists of old, and they've evolved to a higher degree of sophistication, but the same practices are employed. We think of alchemists in terms of turning lead into gold, but it's certainly much more sophisticated than that. This whole process of scientists mimicking what they practiced in the dark sort of cloistered world of the previous eons is really the obfuscation of hidden knowledge, knowledge that has been carried on by the secret societies through all of the generations to today and are still being employed today. What I typically say is you cannot separate the physical from the spiritual and vice versa. You are employing physical forces and spiritual forces in this alchemy of modern science. So what Doug was referring to is when we talk about DNA and particle accelerators, you're utilizing particle accelerators to generate what are called hard X-rays. And hard X-rays are used for looking or inferring the structure of our DNA. You know that our human DNA, the genome, was sequenced many years ago. And that sequencing has led to the ability now to digitally model our DNA. So if you take a strand of DNA, you can convert that DNA to ones and zeros, to binary code. You can transmit that code through the cloud, through the internet, and using a sequencer at the receiving end, reconstruct using that code, reconstruct that DNA using the base chemicals of the DNA, the amino acids, if you will, and be able to grow at that remote location a copy of the original. Now, you can do that on Mars if you choose to. So when we talk about teleportation, we're talking about the transmission of digitized DNA, and that is something that will come through this portal as well.
So this is mind-numbing. I consider myself a pretty smart fellow, but this is boggling my mind. There are scientists out there who look at this type of research, who look at the attempts by cognitive researchers to construct an artificial intelligence and say this is not going to happen. It can't happen because it's way too complex. Does it matter? How important is it that whether this is technologically possible or not? In other words, is the key point here that something may be within their reach, or is the real important fact here that these people believe it and are luring other people into this false belief?
Well, there are two major things taking place when you look at venture capital money. Follow the money for your answer. And in Silicon Valley, in California, the primary funding is going towards defeating death, immortality, and artificial intelligence. And the two are combined. And therefore, you have utilizing quantum computing the ability to model the human brain. You've heard of the initiative from the president last year of creating, of modeling, mapping the human brain. They now have the ability to create a quantum computer that operates interdimensionally. This is real time. This has been going on for 10 years, interdimensional computing, utilizing quantum computers. But they now have the ability to construct a computer that has the identical components of the human brain. Specifically, when we're talking about the computer, we're talking about quantum bits, qubits. The identical number of qubits that matches the number of what are known as tubulin dimmers within the human neuron. So you're matching numbers to numbers in terms of the construct of the human brain and the quantum computer in order to create a match. This is quantum biology. This is combining DNA, quantum computing, and God's model, God's plan for our brain, using that as the model for the artificially intelligent brain.
But as I've talked to cognitive researchers like Dr. Hugo de Garis, he admits that when they try to run data that they input into these neural networks, and they see what comes out the other side, they don't really know what's going on inside that, black box, if you will. Where is that black box again, that black cube? In fact, Sharon, in a presentation a couple of years ago, showed a comic to illustrate this to the people sitting in on a presentation, which were two scientists looking at a whiteboard with a bunch of calculations on one side, and a box in the middle, and then the answer on the other side, and the label on the box in the middle was "Magic happens here." And she said, "This is essentially how cognitive researchers are trying to build an artificial intelligence. They don't know what's happening in the middle. They know they put input in, and data comes out the other side. But the artificial intelligence researchers and the transhumanists are getting people to believe that salvation will come through technology." And I wonder if that isn't the greater danger, because salvation depends on what you believe, rather than the technology actually being created to replicate the human brain.
Yeah, the technology, the ultimate goal is to, one, to steal your soul, and two, to control you. And therefore, it's being sold as the answer to Alzheimer's, to cancer, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, right.
And that is not the truth. And the deception is that to achieve the solution to all of humankind's problems or issues is to do away with the human brain as it exists, according to God's plan, and do away with the human body, to upload your consciousness and, if you will, your soul into a computer that will never die. That's what's being sold to people.
Right.
Even if that was achievable and possible and desirable, it's only going to be done for a select few, not for the entire human race.
Right.
So we get into some complex discussions here, but all of this is real time. All of this is going on. All of us as researchers read the research and present our findings. So we aren't making things up. This isn't conjecture. Right. This is coming from the university level material. And thanks to Douglas, we've been able to present in this book a university level construct of our various areas of research.
Yeah. And I guess the way I would put it is this, and the reason I'm raising this question and this point is because there are researchers out there who will look at the research of, say, Dr. Raymond Kurzweil, and what was the name of his book, How to Build a Brain, who just looked at it and said, this is ridiculous. This is like a few bits of good information with a bunch of, nonsense.
Sure.
But the danger there, I think, is that people, Christians especially, will say, this is technologically impossible, so we don't need to worry about it. And I'd say that is wrong. Mm-hmm.
You have to be worried about it. We're not trying to instill fear, because this is God's plan and he has the control. However, we do need to understand that when you talk about quantum computers, we're not able to intuitively understand how they work, this magic black box that you referred to. The rules are different at the quantum level than at the classical atomic and molecular level. But with that understanding, let me give you just one number. Going back to 2013, there's a quantum computer that had 512 qubits. Now, they've gone way beyond that. But at that time, the parallel to that was equating 512 qubits to the processing power of 7 billion human brains. Hmm. Now, we can't even wrap our heads around that number, and they have far exceeded that number since 2013.
Hmm.
So what I'm trying to impress is it's no longer magic. It's no longer inachievable. It's been proven. So we do have a very real threat to humanity, whether we're talking about our bodies or our minds or even our souls, as Gons was referring to.
Well, again, in the interest of trying to keep this to a manageable length, and I know this is a conversation we could easily do 3 or 4 hours on, but to keep this to a manageable length, we're going to give each of you fellows an opportunity to share with viewers and listeners what you hope is the takeaway from your perspective. We'll start with you, Josh. What do you hope a reader of Revising Reality takes away from this book?
Well, I agree with Anthony where he said that we're not trying to instill fear, and it's not that we need to be afraid of these things, but we do need to be informed of them and how these things might play out. The last chapter that I wrote in the book was on where quantum technologies are going to take us into the future, the very near future. You know, we're not even talking a matter of 5 or 6 decades anymore. It's coming really fast, and a lot of it's already here. But the problem is, a lot of people, especially in the church, especially Christians, they remain uninformed because either, like you said, Derek, either they think it doesn't matter, that it's technologically impossible, which it's not. Or they think it doesn't have any bearing on where they stand with God, just as a Christian. But the problem with that is when these technologies that are already here now, when they become more mainstream, as Christians, we're going to have to answer some tough questions like, where's the line? What's okay with God and what isn't? And instead of making a snap decision right at the time, it's good to get a handle on this stuff now and remain prepared, because of course technology has brought a lot of good things for humanity and has been helpful. I mean, I have a prosthetic hip that allows me to walk around
and forces you to get fondled every airport you go through. So, yeah. So there's that.
I can relate to that.
Yeah, exactly.
It's my hip. Honest. It's totally my, yeah.
it's right.
You're never gonna let me live that down.
That's right. And what's really crazy is when the machines don't go off, you have to explain to the security people that they've really got a problem now.
It was right. Yeah. I've got titanium.
That's right. I got metal in me, and you didn't detect it.
That's right.
Yeah. So technology has brought some really good things to humanity that's been helpful. But we as Christians need to get in the Word of God and get Spirit-filled so we can know where the line is. Because like Anthony said earlier, a lot of these things are being packaged as like cures for cancer or like good things like that. And Derek, you and I and Sharon talked about that on Sci-Friday earlier this week. Or actually, I think it's airing today. But you know, where is that line when it starts getting into gene editing, even if it is curing your cancer, what is that doing to your humanity? And so it's good for us to have these conversations now and to write books and read books like this now, so the church can be aware of what's going on and what is right at the door.
Okay. Gons, your hope when somebody picks up this book, Revising Reality, what do you hope they take away?
Now, I hope they, are encouraged, and it gives them something to consider and a new lens maybe to look at the world around them. But really, I hope this is the beginning of a needed revival, if you will, of Christian apologetics. Because I think that the topics that the academic world has tackled with apologetics is so fundamental for our faith. In the world of philosophy, there are, you know, William Lane Craigs and the Ravi Zacharias who've really made an impact in the academic world. And if you're an atheist, a materialist, you can stay with your arguments with the non-existence of God or whatever. But it has been shown pretty well, you know, I think, in my opinion, that there is a rational, logical, consistent argument for God that doesn't require, you know, any kind of leap in sort of illogical faith or anything that they characterize it as. But now we're moving into this time when those things have been established. Even the world of science is moving away from the hard materialist paradigm. And that vacuum is creating a reawakening of spirituality that is being filled with all kinds of weird, you know, you got New Age stuff. You have, the dangerous stuff is the one that I think the ones that incorporate a Christian worldview, but, you know, sort of twist it around a little bit to fit kind of their, you know, agenda and that kind of thing. So I think it's going to be really important for us to embark on this intellectually, spiritually, to look at the things that are happening and you know, the things we report in technology. But also, I mean, you know, how does this affect your individual everyday, day to day? Well, it already has. I mean, we all have iPhones in our pocket, so it already has affected us. But, you know, you want to look at, you know, the politics of stuff. You can look at the 2030 UN agenda. By 2030, they're going to, you know, eliminate poverty. They have all these things in place that they want to do. And one of it is to have identification available for everybody born on this planet. Okay, so just think about that for a second. How would that even work? You would need a large database, and you would need something that can track those individuals. And this is the foundation of what seems to be relayed to us about the mark of the beast. You can't buy or sell. You can't, you know. So those things, I think, in the world of the church, I hope this embarks on that sort of quest to understand where we are. We don't know when the Lord's returning. You know, no one knows the day or the hour, but the seasons are changing pretty quickly here, and we live in a very interesting time. Yeah. And God has put us here, I think, to be watchmen, to stay alert and aware, and I tend to see a lot of infighting, you know, within even the fringe world or the alt world of conspiracy. There's lots of different opinions and views. But as watchmen, as I say, you know, I always use this analogy. If we're on the watchtower and we're bickering at each other and the enemy's coming over the hill, we're going to miss the enemy. So I think we have to sort of unite under Christ and say, you know what, this is the truth, and we can hold on to that truth and have comfort in that. But we have a job to do as part of our purpose for being in this time. So I hope that, the book sort of starts that kind of thinking in the church and you know, just a revival of apologetics in this new sort of the new world, if you want to call it that, the new world agenda here.
In engaging the brain as well as the heart and the soul.
Yeah.
Anthony, your hope for the book, what would you hope that people reading this book, Revising Reality, get out of it?
Well, I echo my co-authors here, but also this is a saving of souls. We are commanded by Scripture to save souls. I would challenge pastors. I would challenge individual laypersons to grab a hold of this book and to understand that this is a wake-up call to psychologically as well as spiritually prepare your flock. Because imagine the scenario, if we were here and a portal opened, how this world would completely change. Everything else becomes secondary. Any other agenda item, including the Middle East conflicts that are going on, would take a backseat to this portal opening. So this isn't fear-mongering, but this is preparing your flock. And I hear from a lot of listeners who email me and say, I don't hear any of this in my church. I don't hear anything coming from my pastors. I challenge pastors to get this book, to become familiar with this and to do their own research, and for laypersons to do the same thing. We present information that doesn't cover everything. We have a second book in the works. The point is, we're trying to trigger people to do their own critical thinking, their own soul searching, and to think about, if they're not saved, the salvation of their own soul and those around them within their sphere of influence, to reach out to them as well. Again, not in a fearful manner, but in, this is God's plan, but this is how Lucifer is trying to usurp God's plan. And here it is laid out in this book.
Hmm. And Doug, as the publisher, will give you the last word. Revising Reality, A Biblical Look into the Cosmos, Volume 1. What was your goal, your purpose, and your hope for this book when you went into the project?
Well, my sense was that there had been a lot of research. We've mentioned a number of the parties that we've looked to. We also should mention that Stan Dale wrote just a stunning foreword for us.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So people are going to be intrigued by that. It's a great hook. But, you know, the real context, we're kind of missing context for all this. And it's cosmology. And it's the cosmos. And we don't mean cosmetology. We mean cosmology. And cosmos means a structured reality. But we've been living, all of us in our lifetimes, even us older folks, we've been living under the naturalist, materialist point of view. That's the reality, the way it's been described. The most popular public TV program of all time was Carl Sagan's Cosmos. Mm-hmm. And it really positions and places the whole cosmos as a naturalist, materialist, godless reality. And so one of the messages of Revising Reality is that we need to revise our thinking as Christians to realize that, no, the cosmos as described by science of old is not compatible with the biblical idea. There are new great research that's being done by people like a Michael Heiser or whatever that are revising reality. We want folks to understand that. That's part of Romans 12, renewing our minds. That we shouldn't be conformed to the way the world thinks, but we should think in context of what the Bible teaches. There are so many discoveries, whether it's looking at ancient texts or it's looking at modern science, and we have, as Anthony mentioned and as you referenced, you know, this is Volume 1. The name Revising Reality hints at some of the areas that we need to look at, and we will go to in the next volume, which would be things like the digital world simulation. Mm-hmm. That would revise reality. How about the Mandela effect? That would revise reality beyond what we could even imagine, changing the way that we remember things. And so Revising Reality is a very far-reaching concept. It is a pulling together of those things that influence our understanding of the cosmos. Mm. And so, you know, I guess my final thought would be to remember that the Bible is a cosmology book. It begins with God creating the heavens and the earth. It ends with a new Jerusalem, a new cosmos that God will bring about. And it also, in the first chapter of Genesis, it places humanity at the center of this. And so far from the vision of a Carl Sagan, where we're sort of passive observers on a very average planet around an average sun, around an average galaxy. No, the Bible says we actually are the crown of creation. And God cares that we not manipulate our DNA and that we not try to revise the way that we're built. But we recognize that he loves us. He also died for us. And the fact that that God was incarnated into the cosmos, into our body, is forever a underscoring of the importance of humanity to him. And so I hope that people are supercharged to understand that cosmology is really a very big cornerstone of our ability to conduct spiritual warfare in the days ahead.
Yeah. And I think that the fact that our senses have been dulled to the spirit realm through our naturalistic indoctrination makes us essentially soldiers on the battlefield with no no clue that we're even being shot at, which is a good way to get yourself killed. Revising Reality, A Biblical Look into the Cosmos, Volume 1. The authors you've been hearing from during this conversation, Anthony Patch, Doug Woodward, Gan Shimura, Josh Peck. Gentlemen, I know we've only scratched the surface of this, but hopefully that will be enough to whet the appetite of folks who hear or see this. And when you get somebody like Stan Deo, who's excited about the book, you can tell that from his foreword, Paul McGuire, calling it mind-blowing. When Paul McGuire says it's mind-blowing, based on some of the stuff that he's written about over the past few years, you know you've done something. Gentlemen, it has been an honor to host this discussion. And Anthony, pleasure to meet you, and hope we can talk again. And I extend that to all of you fellows as we move into the new year. We got the holidays coming up on us, but it looks like with each passing day, it just feels like the time is growing shorter and shorter. So let's get about the king's business while we have the time. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. We sure appreciate it.
Thanks, Jake.
Thank you.
Check the show notes at vftb.net and at youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. If you're watching this on video, there'll be links to the websites of all of our guests in the show notes to find out more about Doug, Anthony, Gans, and Josh and what they are up to. Again, the book is a fascinating read. Even if you're relatively familiar with the material like I am, Revising Reality is... well, let's say it would make a great holiday gift for somebody you know who is getting curious about these subjects, but really hasn't dug deeply into it yet. This is a primer. It takes them from Genesis 6 to the Large Hadron Collider, all in the span of one trade paperback. That's a pretty big undertaking, and they've done a good job of it. The thing I find fascinating about that research is that it really dovetails with what I've been working on, which is focusing mainly on the history of the ancient Near East and how it relates to the spiritual war that is contained in the pages of the Bible. But we're not often taught about it in church because, as we discussed during the conversation, we English speakers have a problem with the word G-O-D, and we assign attributes to it that aren't there in the original text. If the Bible can call these fallen spirit beings, call them fallen angels if you want, but if the Bible can refer to them as gods, and God in the Bible refers to them as gods, then we're on pretty solid ground when we call them gods as well, as long as we understand that they are created beings, not the creator, and not deserving of our worship. The old gods never went away. The idea that they're coming back is a psyop intended to fool the deluded, those who are in the occult, the pagans, into thinking that somehow happy days are on their way back. And this idea that we're trying to get back to this golden age of Kronos, I'll have to explore this more. I may not have room for it in the book that I'm working on now, 40,000 pages, and I still haven't gotten halfway through, but 40,000 words, not pages, 40,000 words. But the golden age of Kronos plays an important part in the cosmology of certain people groups that had a big impact on the history of the Israelites and thus on the history of all of us who call on Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. So we'll get into that. There are some very strong links between history and mythology. Scholars know about it. They just haven't bothered to tell us in the church. So that is what I am working on and will be taking time this week and in the month of December as we get a little time away from our daily jobs, responsibilities here at Skywatch TV. I'll be working on trying to get the manuscript finished because I promised Tom Horn that I would. This week being the week of Thanksgiving, we will not have a View from the Bunker this coming weekend. And I suspect we'll also take a week away from the Gilbert House Fellowship, our weekly Bible study. But double check to be sure. You can always find us online, vftb.net. And of course, the Facebook page, facebook.com/viewfromthebunker. And if there's any change to that, we'll certainly post it there. One way or the other, we'll post it and let you know. The same with the Gilbert House Fellowship at gilberthouse.org. We also have a Facebook page for the Gilbert House Fellowship, which is where Sharon and I post the weekly Bible studies that we record. It's about an hour, give or take 15 minutes or thereabouts, depending on the passages, the selections of scripture that we've chosen for that week. We're going through the Bible in chronological order. We're doing the Old Testament and the New Testament, about an hour of each Sunday. Try to get those posted by about midday Sunday. Some days we're more successful at that than at others. Depends on how much study we have to get done in order to do justice to the text. We're certainly no scholars, but hopefully what we can communicate is that you don't need to be a scholar to get more out of the Bible than you think you can. But again, this week being Thanksgiving weekend, we will likely take the week to rest and recharge. I'll probably just be writing, but that's okay. It's good stuff. Every Monday, and again, this coming Monday, tomorrow, by the time you hear this, assuming you're listening to this on Sunday night, episode 12 of The God Conspiracy will be released. It's the audiobook version of my novel, The God Conspiracy, which has been out for a few years, but still seems very timely, which is surprised me because I didn't think I was that forward thinking in a period, much less in trying to create a fictional world. But the story, even though it's about a decade old, is holding up pretty well, which, again, surprised me in the days in which we live, in which technology is changing so rapidly. But you want to listen to it for free? Be my guest. The website is thegodconspiracy.tk. That'll take you to the YouTube playlist. These are being released as YouTube videos, mainly just audio. There's some, you know, graphics and stuff that our friend Jake Rahutsky put together for us, and I do owe him a debt of gratitude for putting these together. But, yeah, we're up to episode 12 now, a little less than halfway through. So still time for you to go back and listen to it in about 20 to 30 minute chunks each week, released every Monday morning, 9 a.m. Central Time. That's UTC-6. And another episode coming up tomorrow morning, Monday. This coming week on Skywatch TV, it's week number 2 with Tom Horn and Josh Peck. You don't want to miss it because the conversation is fascinating. It's about their forthcoming book, Abaddon Ascending, which is about the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Geneva, Wisconsin, Switzerland, Geneva, Switzerland, and what might be lurking underneath the mountains of Switzerland, or what they might hope to open beneath the mountains of Switzerland. Check the website, skywatchtv.com, for listings of dates and times to watch the program. Of course, if you've got Roku, you'll be able to see it beginning Monday morning on demand, the Skywatch TV channel on Roku. Thank you for your reviews and your ratings at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else fine podcasts are sold. When again, give us a like at Facebook, facebook.com/viewfromthebunker. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.